From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. This Tuesday, we'll see two more presidential primaries, one in Kentucky and one in Oregon. With more on that, we're going to go back to Professor Tony Montero. We've been speaking with him regularly about this. And what do you see here, Tony?
I see Sanders and his movement as competitive in both places. I wouldn't rule out Sanders taking Kentucky because of his win in West Virginia and in Indiana. Indiana is a bordering state to Kentucky. And I think the conditions that propelled him in Indiana and West Virginia are similar to what's in Kentucky. As far as the far west is concerned, in Oregon, you know, Sanders has done very well in the far west, including the state of Washington and Colorado and other places, Nevada. So I think the insurgency movement within the Democratic Party seems to be doing well and seems to be picking up momentum in spite of all of the pressure of the corporate media and the Democratic Party establishment to discredit it and undermine it and misdirect it. I think it continues. And I think the thing that is really pushing it is the enthusiasm, especially of young voters who have no investment at all in the Democratic Party as such, but have decided to challenge the establishment in the primary elections. And this is quite significant. So I would say that Sanders does very well in both of the primaries and will possibly win both, which is the doorway to California. And if he wins both, then he goes into California having won, I think, six of the last seven or seven of the last seven primaries.
Yeah, he has a total so far of 19 states where he's won either the primary or the caucus. So it's pretty, he's definitely still in the game. You know, we're looking at a situation where, according to Sanders yesterday in Kentucky, more than 400 of the superdelegates announced that they were for Clinton before there was a single ballot cast by Democrats in the primaries. And what Sanders is doing is targeting the elected delegates, looking to get a majority of those or to be very close and sitting on top of poll numbers that show him doing better than Clinton against Trump. While Clinton says that all must be done to beat Trump. And I guess what he's doing is making a case to persuade the superdelegates to vote with the popular vote, and that should put him over the top. What do you think are the prospects for that at the DNC in Philly?
Well, I think an unknown variable or variable that's not yet been fully factored in is the fact that several hundred thousand protesters will descend upon Philadelphia for that for those days of the Democratic Party convention, and what the sheer weight of those masses of people camping out in the city of Philadelphia will, the effect that that will have upon the superdelegates, as well as the fact that it is possible, and I think quite probable, that Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders will come to the convention without having won the requisite number of pledge delegates to put either over the top. And they might come into Philadelphia, into the convention, with pretty much an equal number of pledge delegates, which means you have a contested convention. And then you factor in what I'm estimating will be several hundred thousand, if not more, to tell you the truth, protesters, everything from the Democracy Spring people to the environmentalist movement to the anti-police state, anti-national security state. I mean, it will be a democratic efflorescence, a democratic renaissance, a democratic celebration in the streets of Philadelphia, and protesting against the anti-democracy of the Democratic Party, but of the entire electoral political system. This is the, if I might just put it this way, this will be 4 years after the crushing of Occupy Wall Street. This will be Occupy Wall Street coming back with a vengeance.
And it's also 48 years after there were thousands and thousands of protesters at the 1968 convention, and what that led to was the coronation of Hubert Humphrey under the direction of then Mayor Daley and the party elite. If that happens in Philadelphia, what do you think the response is going to be, both on the street and then going forward into the election?
Well, first of all, the civil disobedience which is being planned will shut Philadelphia down. Now, the convention, just so people will know, the site of the convention is far from the center of the city. But it is located in a place where if the demonstrators choose to, they can shut down interstate highways, they can shut down major thoroughfares leading into the center of the city, and by occupying the center of the city, shut business down in the center of the city. I think this is huge because such a outpouring of protest would be an attack upon the Democratic Party itself, hence delegitimizing it and its leaders. And if Hillary is the one that the party bosses choose to coronate, to put in power over the Democratic wishes of millions of voters, tens of millions of voters, I think that it's very difficult for her to unite the party as a whole, that is to say, all of the people who participated in the primaries, along with independent voters, along with, and I put quotes, moderate Republicans, you know, all of those people who constituted the Obama coalition in 2008 and 2012, it would be virtually impossible for her to unite them. The other thing is, if she is the Democratic nominee, she will be dogged from July to November by demonstrations and protests and calling her out as who she is, a war maker, a corrupt politician, the instrument of Wall Street and the Pentagon. I mean, I think if the Democratic Party leaders have any ounce of sense, they will not make Hillary Clinton their nominee. And the other side of it is, and don't think they're going to fly in Joe Biden or maybe Elizabeth Warren to save the day for them. People are, this is a great democratic uprising. And so that's the way I see it right now.
There's a website, rallybus.net, that is organizing bus trips into Philadelphia for a march on the 25th, the opening day of the convention, July 25th, from City Hall downtown out to the Wells Fargo Center where the convention will be held. And they're offering both a single-day round trip for people to participate in a march on the 25th and also a three-day round trip, which allows people to stay for the whole convention. So the infrastructure for this kind of mass protest is already being developed.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well, and that's the organized part of it. What about the spontaneous part of it? I mean, those are buses. There'll be people walking from as far away as New York and Washington, D.C., and even further, who will be marching from various sites to Philadelphia. And people who will be coming in small, discrete groups with particular interests. You know, I know the Democracy Spring people are going to be there in huge numbers and very militant. And they're not just going to be there for one day. Already, there's being planned a series of workshops and seminars and panels for every day of the convention, having to do with issues of socialism, of war and peace, of economic inequality, of white supremacy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and putting the socialist alternative as the alternative to capitalist greed. So, we just are not able to predict the numbers who will be coming and the impact upon not just the convention, but the social economy, the political economy, the political system going forward. I think the people are in the streets and the people are not going back into their homes until basic and fundamental change is made, especially in the political system.
You know, we've been talking about that and the fact that you have these two movements, these masses of people who are disaffected, who have lost confidence in the political institutions and other institutions, by the way, behind both Sanders and Trump. And now, just yesterday, even Clinton has acknowledged the fact that people are angry, and she speaks about it in almost generic terms and treats it as something that's both understandable and to be feared and rejected. She seems to be speaking both about Sanders supporters and Trump supporters, almost bunching them together. Do you think that that's a winning strategy for her?
Well, no, it's not a winning strategy. I don't think there is a winning strategy for Hillary Clinton, to be frank. You know, Barack Obama, at the commencement speech that he gave at Rutgers University yesterday, indicated that that's going to be their appeal to the millennials, to the youth vote. He said to them that anti-intellectualism is no virtue, but and that they should vote, and they should vote as intelligent voters. I just don't think they have the capacity to understand what is going on in the streets. And it seems like the Democratic establishment is making the same mistake that the Republican establishment made. That is underestimating the depth of anger and distress and fear and anxiety of, well, tens of millions of working people who are voting their anger. They are rejecting the establishment. Now, on the other side, I think there is a current within the left which does pretty much the same thing that the Republican Party and Democratic Party establishments have done. That is to diminish the significance of what is going on the ground and the distress of the working people of this country. By saying that, well, you know, Sanders is not a real socialist. Well, so what? But if you take the Bernie Sanders movement, there are quote unquote real socialists and real radicals throughout this movement, and people who are becoming more radical as this movement goes forward. The same thing on the Republican side. You know, Jeb Bush spent over $120 million and got nothing, because you cannot buy off a mass movement. You can buy off leaders of mass movements, but you cannot buy off mass movements of this type. The people will find a way. and will find leaders that express their interests. And this is where we are in the history of this country. I think it's a historic moment. The paradigm of politics, which has been in place for about 70 years now, is shifting, and profoundly so. We are on the cusp of what could possibly be the breakup of the two-party duopoly that has ruled us for all of this time.
You know, you mentioned 70 years as a time frame for this paradigm, this political paradigm. And you're referring, I'm sure, to the removal of Henry Wallace from basically the heir to Franklin Roosevelt from the ticket in 1944, and the replacement with Harry Truman, and the development of a Republican and Democratic consensus that was both architects and purveyors of the Cold War, anti-communist hysteria, and the whole diminishing of the value of the term socialism, and even the idea of unions and workers' movements, and the development of policy that has led us here, where we have the U.S. military up against Russia and China's borders. Two new wars just started over this weekend, with the U.S. sending troops into Libya and Yemen. The ongoing wars in a dozen other countries across Africa and the Middle East, and the complete impoverishment of the working class and much of the middle class in this country. How do you put that out, spending even $1 billion in advertising?
Well, you can't. I mean, you know, listen, and you're right. And when we talk about 70 years, we're talking about the Cold War in both of its phases. Cold War during the time of the Soviet Union, and the Cold War after the demise of the Soviet Union. The Cold War was the justification for the busting of unions, the criminalizing of radical thought and dissent in the universities, in the political system, in the civil rights movement, in the labor movement. And this, of course, was done with the collaboration of so-called liberals, what we call Cold War liberals. And the Cold War liberal establishment has led to what we today call the black misleadership class and the labor misleadership class. Those leaders, and I put quotes around that, who were prepared to cooperate with the exploiters and oppressors of the people in the interest of fighting communism or fighting terrorism. I think we are probably at the end of that era. But imperialism is not going into the night without a fight. I think you may have read over the weekend, I got this from the BBC, of the plans going forward to place U.S. so-called defensive missiles, probably cruise missiles and other types, in southern Romania, and to link those missiles to proposed missile systems in Poland, not to mention the ongoing NATO operations in the Baltic states north of Russia. And then, of course, the plans to take back Crimea, and the constant building up of military forces in the Ukraine. I mean, this is a dangerous world that we live in. And of course, this is the backdrop for the election of 2016. And this is why, in the correlation of political forces, you have to look at these mass movements. And you have to see Clinton as the most dangerous major political force in the world today. And you know, that's the way I look at it. You know, the people could put an end to the warfare state, to the austerity state, to the national security state, to the incarceration state, to the police state, if they choose to. History is now in the hands of the people. And that's why, as you know, I've always focused upon these insurgency movements rather than upon the personalities that appear to be at the forefront of them.
You know, on that point, looking back to the 1932 election when Roosevelt was elected, you know, he ran against Herbert Hoover's America, the condition of the country at that time. You had active political movements, strong communist, socialist, union activity on the ground. You didn't have an organized effort to take over the Congress. And so when Roosevelt took office in 1933, he had pretty much the same condition that the next president is going to face here, a Congress that is not exactly of these movements. Yet he managed to get his program through because of the support from the ground, the massive support from the ground. How do we organize that going forward so that whoever comes into office in January of next year is forced to move towards a people's agenda of that type?
Well, you know, I would just make one distinction between 32 and 2016, and that is the fact that the United States has become a imperial empire with 1,000 military bases in 130 countries. This investment in war and maintaining this military empire is a huge impediment, not only to democracy in the country, but to human progress itself. And then when you combine that with this neoliberal globalization, which with the TPP would be put on steroids, you're looking at an investment in a reactionary, almost neo-fascist reorganization of the global economy, politics, and international relationships that no one in the 1930s could have imagined. This reorganization of global human and international relationships is eroding, undermining, and attacking liberal or bourgeois democracy in the United States itself, while at the same time impoverishing the American working people, wiping out the whole mythology of a middle class or middle income majority. We're now looking at the immiseration of the American working people and the shutting down of any sense of a future for young people. This is a crisis of unprecedented proportions for the American people and for the world. If I might just say one other thing, Don, because, you know, as you know, I have felt that this election could be and probably will be fought out over international questions. Trade deals, TPP in particular, NAFTA, and the U.S. Military empire. But this global situation is complicated by the fact that with these insurgency movements, which push the American working people towards the left and against the right, at the same time in South America, you have the U.S. policy of regime change being ratcheted up in Venezuela, of course, in Honduras, in Brazil, in Argentina. The regime change policies. So the right seemingly is ascendant in South America, while the right is under attack in the United States. So at some point, what is happening here in North America and what is happening in South America, in other words, a reascendant left would complement the ascendancy of a broad left insurgency here in the United States. Now, on the other side, the United States situation seems to mirror what is going on in Europe, everything from Great Britain to Spain and Greece and Germany, as you know, where when Obama went there, I think last month, there were huge demonstrations against the transatlantic investment partnership.
Yeah, TTIP.
The TIPP.
Yeah.
So I think the world is in the throes of a great conflict to decide the future.
Yeah. Finally, on that note, you had, you know, for years now, we've been mapping first in Latin America, and then with the BRICS, the rise of, you know, an alternate construct, essentially, multipolarity.
Right.
And you're seeing the rise of, you know, this pro-worker, anti-imperial movement, or pair of movements, here in the United States. Now a revanchment against that multipolarity, gaining some successes. You mentioned Brazil, Argentina, the stress that Venezuela has been facing, Bolivia, the recent referendum there, also India entering into military alliance with the U.S., basically pulling the B, I, and S out of the BRICS with the stress that South Africa is also under. What role should the working class here be, you know, looking at? It's playing, being played out in this election, in that whole global struggle.
Yeah. Well, you know, see, I would start. Well, I think there are two pillars here. I think the broad democratic forces within the labor movement and within the working class in general. When I say democratic, I'm talking about forces that say that unions should be controlled by the people who are their members, not by a bureaucratic elite. I'm talking about forces that are anti-racist and anti-Islamophobic and anti-immigrant. You know, forces that fight for the unity of the working class. That's basic democracy in the class and trade union movement. On the other side, we have to begin to think about what a 21st century left movement would look like in the United States. You know, it's my estimate that what we call the left in this country, or the radical left or the revolutionary left, is stuck in a period of history which we have transcended. We are in a new era in the crisis of capitalism and of imperialism and of the American empire. And it's manifested in this political crisis of leadership. Who will lead or who will be at the political helm of the of American imperialism? And, you know, all of their proposed leaders are under attack, as well as the institutions. So I see a democratic movement and a left movement resurgency as a necessity if we are to consolidate what these insurgencies have done, the space that these insurgencies have created for new democratic movements, for new left movements.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.